From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I'm sorry, so sorry, that I was such a fool.
We've all uttered those words, I'm sorry, even so sorry. And it feels pretty good to hear someone else say it. In fact, an apology can matter a lot more than we realize.
I think it's a real genuine need, as strong as like the need to eat or to drink. It's part of the need of relating in general, to want to apologize and to reforge the connection that's in some way been damaged.
This hour, we'll explore the real meaning of saying you're sorry. Also, the perils of false contrition. And the Japanese ritual of apologizing to aborted fetuses, the Muzuko Kuyo.
I'm sorry, so sorry, please accept my apology.
First, Steve Paulson talks with Kerry Sudler, a man who discovered his family once owned slaves. He took a tape recorder back to his hometown in Maryland and found much more than he bargained for.
Watch your step.
Where were the slaves kept around here?
Most of them in the basement. They had slave quarters. We don't have any actual shackles or anything down here. You gotta realize that this was all dirt floors. I busted through here. This is the width of the thing. And we concreted all this. See if I can find a light to turn on. Stand right still. Yeah. And of course, you can see the age. See how porous the bricks are? When it rains, the water just comes in. They had coal, they're using coal down here. See where they have, we covered that up?
Oh, yeah.
That little brick section there.
Mm-hmm.
And we put this furnace in and bricked all that back in there. Of course, it's expensive, heating 16 rooms.
That is your cousin, Foster Sudler Willis, giving you a tour of Sledmore, one of two plantations your family owned in Sudlersville on the east coast of Maryland. When did you first find out your family owned slaves?
When I was growing up, my father would talk about it now and then with sort of a sense of pride, and I didn't think that much of it because, you know, didn't everybody own slaves? I mean, you sort of assume it. It's kind of like if you eat a certain kind of food all the time, you assume everybody else does. You know, we had this grandfather clock that was built in the early 1700s and all this sort of legacy, and I just didn't pay much attention. And when he died, I inherited a family Bible that was written in this quill ink, or passages, pages and pages of it, in the mid-1700s. And in it, it listed humans and what they had sold for in shillings and pounds and early dollars. And it was just so clinical. It was shocking to me because this is not the experience of everybody else. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really kind of troubling to me, and I didn't really understand it. And also, honestly, I didn't really believe it. I mean, can this be true?
Well, and in fact, I'd like to read a few entries from the Sudler family record because I think it really puts it in black and white, just what we're talking about here. Let me just read a few entries, and I'm quoting here. Memorandum, December 1801, bought two Negro boys, 210 pounds, of Mr. George Tull, Vic's Jock and Jack, and the said Tull sold one Negro woman named Sarah to Michael Murray for $100. Judah had a little one in the cornfield while gathering peas, Wednesday, September 25th, 1811, boy child named Pedum. Arnold ran away on Whit Sunday, May 21st, 1825, and was taken up in the Delaware State on Monday the 23rd by Mr. Peter Stewart. Tubman Sudler went up after Arnold on Thursday the 26th. It really makes it very real, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And you wonder what your part is in this. I mean, of course I wasn't alive then. Most of my white friends or white associates will say, hey, it wasn't you, you weren't there. But something occurred to me a few years ago, which is really simple, that if I choose to carry my family's name and there might be some good stuff attached to that, you know, I have to really carry its full legacy. You can't just be all the good stuff and then deselect all the icky part and just show the world the highlight reel. Because much of the social access, if you will, that I have is clearly earned on the backs of other people and on their arms and legs.
You did something pretty unusual. After you discovered this family history, you went out with a tape recorder and talked to a lot of relatives, some on the black side, some on the white side, and we have a bit of tape from a white Sudlerville relative, 80-year-old William Sudler Goodhand, showing that racism is not just a thing of the past.
Colored people, to me, in my lifetime here, were never any kind of a hindrance or any kind of anything. They were just what was here. That was part of the way life was. So nobody, there was never, I didn't know of any animosity when I was a young fella. I didn't know of any. And as you pick and choose your friends, we pick and chose ours, and they pick and chose theirs, and everybody got along pretty well. And like the colored man today, that as he gets his education and as he acts more like he should act, like a human being should act, he's accepted more and more. And the only thing that keeps him from not being completely accepted is they are different.
That's really something.
Yeah, it is. Steve, to have been standing on a plantation that once was a slave plantation and is now surrounded by soybeans and corn and this and that, and to have a guy 9 generations later, still family, sipping on iced tea or a mint julep, whatever it was, and tell you about colored people. What was odd to me is after 80 years, I thought, well, how many have you met with the last name and what are they like? And of course, not a finger had ever been lifted to go meet them.
Well, you did something quite unusual. You chased down a lot of relatives, descendants of your family's slaves who actually have the same name as you, Carrie Sudler. Let's hear another bit of tape.
I have to say I was a little nervous to call because part of the reason I'm calling is that the reason that you and I probably have the same last name is not through the best circumstances in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, this may sound a little weird, but I just want to apologize for any difficulty that life is as far as racism and all the rest of it. And I want to let you know that you have somebody with the same last name who's interested in having a level playing field for everybody, and that I don't suppose the white side of the family ever apologized to the black side. I really don't know if they ever did or didn't, but I just want to let you know that it does not continue even in silence.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that and certainly welcome that. So that's a good feeling that goes with that. Let me assure you there are no issues with me along those lines, trying to understand all the things that happened. I guess it's more important to me just to try to understand, you know, what went on.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm thrilled just the fact that you called.
So you deliberately set out to apologize to some of the black descendants of your family slaves.
Yeah, I couldn't find any record, and I don't know of any instance where my family has ever officially or formally or informally apologized to any of these people. And there are hundreds of them and hundreds of them out there, descendants. And I think it has to happen. I think it's important that they know that they're important people, as important as I am or you are or anything else. And that if I don't do anything about this, it just continues, and a larger invisible oppression continues, and I'm a participant of it.
How did you feel doing this, making these kinds of apologies?
I was scared. I have to admit that. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I didn't know if they were going to yell, you know, swear at me or hit me or I don't know. It was really a major, you know, felt really risky to do it, but I had to do it. I had to do it. And whatever was going to happen would have been worth it. And it has been worth it.
we have another bit of tape, and I think this is a response of a black settler you met in a store near your old family plantation.
Your white skin gives you access to almost anything that you want. I'm followed in grocery stores, and I'm followed in department stores still. Is it better? Yeah, it's better in my own lifetime. It's better. But it's not perfect. It hasn't improved. And white people still say, yeah, I have black friends, and they say that I'm not racist. But if you have to make that statement, then there must be some racism somewhere. I certainly am racist still. I still have to work past all of that stuff because there's jealousy, envy, and sometimes hate when I look at the things that other people have access to that I don't have.
What did you say to that person?
I was talking about access, and I had been in the White House earlier that day because I talked my way into it, which I know how to do. And I really didn't know what to do, so I small-talked the guy up in the beginning and just asked him, you know, what's it like to walk around in a town with this name? It's your last name, but you're not the white guy, so maybe you don't feel the same. And he really did turn and just put it to me really brutally like that. And what a wake-up call, because it never occurred to me that if he and I were shopping in the same place, that the security guys are going to be following him around just because he's black. And maybe I'm the one stealing. But he's the one that they follow just because of his skin color. You know, one of the other conversations we had is that ever since he was born, he was taught that he was lazy and stupid and ugly. I mean, imagine growing up your whole life thinking you're lazy, stupid, and ugly, and all of your people are too. So you never really kind of climb out of that because you're told it's hopeless and don't even bother. And here I was raised not to think that I was stupid or lazy or ugly, but that I can do whatever I want and be the next president, that kind of thing. He was never told that. So I was handed a whole different kind of access, two people with the same name, except one is black and one is white. And here he is just trying to buy a shirt, and they're tracking him down like a dog. It's just really wrong, you know?
What did you say to him? Did you tell him you're sorry?
I did. I said, you know, I would like to apologize for the way that your life is right now and any participation that my family may have had in it in the last several hundred years in creating a world that is the way it is for you right now, that you were brought here against your will, your family, your great-great-great-great-grandfather 9 generations ago, maybe in chains, you know, maybe whatever went on that was really painful that has created a reality for him today that is so much more difficult than my reality, and needlessly so. I really don't know what you say to somebody. I mean, I wasn't given the manual or the lessons on how to do this, and I've gone it alone. And a lot of white people really resent me and think that I have no business doing this. I wasn't there. It wasn't my fault. But I carry my family's name, and I carry what it's done, both good and bad. What do you do in life? You just try and do the next right thing, even if you don't understand it.
You know, there is another response that some people might have to all this, a more cynical response that really what you're doing as a white American is you're just trying to appease your guilty conscience by apologizing.
I wouldn't deny it. I wouldn't deny it. I do have a guilty conscience. I mean, I grew up around a whole lot of serious bigotry, and I saw people get hurt, and I've seen people get hurt. I do feel bad about that, and I'm sensitive to it. So it is hard work on a daily basis to try and overcome bigotry and fear, because that's really what it is. It's fear. I don't really know how to do it. I sure wasn't taught it in school.
Well, it's obvious how powerful this whole experience has been for you. I mean, how important it has been to apologize. Do you have any sense of whether the black settlers you talk to, the descendants of your family's slaves, whether they get anything out of your apologies?
Well, only what they said was that They were really glad that I had called. I don't think they knew what to say either, because every single one of them had never had this experience and had never expected ever to have this experience, just as I never expected to do it or to ever hear of it, really.
And you have to wonder, is saying sorry enough?
I don't suppose it's enough, but all I can really do, because I don't have piles of money to pay people or do anything, but it's like a living amend, if that makes sense, where my behavior does not contribute to their continued oppression. I mean, that's kind of all I can do. I don't suppose it's enough. I wish I could do more, but at this point in my life, this is kind of all I can do right now.
Kerry Sudler, talking with Steve Paulson. Sudler lives in Los Angeles, and he's still digging into his family's past. Both sides.
I would imagine that there are still some black people that carry the Sudler name around here.
Oh, yeah, there are. I don't know any of them. I really don't, but I know there are some. I know a rather, to me, is a funny story that Dad, my father, was with three other men, and he was going to a ball game in Baltimore. And he was doing some pretty heavy bragging about the Sudlers and how they were pretty straight people and one thing and another. And I wasn't paying too much attention to driving. He was driving and a cop stopped him. Now, I've forgotten what they got stopped for. It didn't make any difference. But they got their ticket. It was a great big colored policeman. And when he signed it, his name was Sudler. So there was quite a lot of joking about that, of course. So.
Echo!
The sounds from the jail cells of the Wilmington 10 are echoes of a massacre, keeping black freedom locked in. The sounds of struggle you hear that are filling your world today are echoes of the voices your fathers killed and smothered away. You can still my I dare you to try to hush my song. My screams of freedom will flood the air of your children, centuries unborn. Oh, nothing but an echo.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
you should say sorry if you broke your friend's favorite toy. You say sorry if you changed the channel and the channel is just on with your friend's favorite on the channel.
Oh, the wisdom of children. Even as adults, we don't always apologize when we break a friend's toy or change the channel without asking first. And you know what? If we do say we're sorry, we probably don't mean it. And that causes even more pain. So, what do we teach our children about apologizing? Well, consider how it would look to you if you were a child. Suppose you get in a fight with the kid next door. Mom finds out. She marches you right over to the neighbor's house and forces you to apologize. You say, sorry. But Mom says, say it like you mean it. And so you manage to utter a suitable, I'm sorry. Psychologist Robert Caron, the author of The Forgiving Self, says a forced apology just makes the problem worse.
Forgiveness gets devalued and becomes a rote experience for a lot of people, partly because anger gets devalued as well, or not devalued so much as demonized, so that you're not allowed to have your anger, to work with it, to express it. And sometimes kids really need to express their anger a lot at their parents, at their friends. And, you know, you see two kids screaming at each other in the playground. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
What I guess I'm wondering, thinking about that situation, though, is that if you really are angry at the other kid, you've listened to your parents, you know that it's not good to feel that kind of anger permanently. But how do you go about getting from there to really feeling sorry about what you've done and maybe more important, expressing that feeling of being sorry?
Well, I think for both kids and adults, in order to really forgive, we have to have it out with each other. You learn about that in childhood. You learn that, you know, wow, you know, I was so angry at him a half hour ago, and I was screaming at him and telling him I hated him and never wanted to be his friend again. He couldn't come to my house, and I was never going to go to his house. And, hey, we're playing like it never happened. And I think you'll learn from experiences like that, you know, anger is something that you can get over, that it doesn't have to turn to bitterness and resentment, that you don't have to keep somebody in the doghouse. When you're not allowed your anger, when anger becomes taboo, or when anger becomes this thing that everyone in the family dreads because it only comes out in explosiveness or in destructive, traumatic ways, then you have this kind of binary anger situation that, you know, follows you through life, where you try to repress it as much as you can and only get to express it in ways that are destructive for you and the people around you.
It sounds so reasonable when you put it that way, but then I think about my mom, who really wanted me to go over and say I was sorry, and maybe it's just because I've lived with that all my life, but it seems like the right thing to do.
I don't think it is the right thing to do. I think you really need to talk to a kid about his feelings and let him have his feelings and really help him to understand his feelings. Like, what is he so upset about? What hurt him? What made him so angry? But I don't think it's a good place to go with a kid to just automatically assume he's got to apologize or he's got to forgive, that there isn't some process he needs to go through first. And I think when your mom says to you, come on, we're going straight over there and you're apologizing or you're going to forgive, without really getting a sense of what it is you've gone through or giving you a chance to express it and understand it better yourself, I think she's doing you a disservice.
So I guess the real question is, what's the purpose of the apology? As an adult, in order for an apology to be really effective, it sounds as though, I mean, you have to have something you're trying to accomplish by making that apology, and it has to be something you can fully understand.
Yeah, and I think it has to come from really a desire to atone in some way, to take responsibility. And this is something you really want to do. I'm really on two accounts. On the one side, you realize that you've caused pain, that it's been unwarranted, that you've been unfair in some way, that maybe you've committed some act of betrayal or misunderstanding, or who knows? There's all kinds of ways in which we hurt each other, and it's a natural part of life, and we feel a need to make the other person whole and to let him know, you know, I feel bad at what I did to you, and you shouldn't go on feeling like you deserved it in any way. The other part of it is that we want to make ourselves whole, that we don't want to live with this sense of wrongdoing. We really have a need, a desire to reconnect with the other person in a way that makes the relationship feel whole.
You know, in order to get that really understood, I guess, there is the other half of the equation. I mean, it does take two people. It is not simply enough to apologize. You have to have a response. I don't know whether it's forgiveness or not, but you have to have a response from the person to whom you're apologizing, don't you?
Not necessarily. I think we all want it. I think in most cases we probably deserve it, at least at some point. But we have to respect each other's processes, you know. We had to go through a process in order to arrive at a point where we realize, hey, you know, I really need to apologize in this situation. I may have been hurt too, and I may have my grievances, but, you know, I can see my part. There's something I need to do. It doesn't necessarily mean the other person has arrived at the same place or that what we say is going to bring him to that place. And, of course, you know, we may have done something that was very grievous, or we may have touched a hot spot in him that goes back to early traumas that he hasn't gotten over. Just because we apologize, it doesn't necessarily mean the other person is going to be right there where we would like him to be. Who knows how long it might take before that apology really works its way to the place where he feels, oh, wow, there's something I need to do back, because I want this connection rebuilt as well.
You know, it strikes me that they got to the point where they were able to say they were sorry after a very long time, in much the same way that a boy who has been in a fight on the playground might get to the point of saying, I'm sorry, after a while, in better shape than if his mom dragged him over there and made him.
One of the reasons it becomes harder when your mom drags you is because you get this sense that you have to defend against being bad. You know, oh, I'm bad because I'm not apologizing. I'm bad because of what I've done. And the sense of badness is something that I feel profoundly but also need to defend against. And my pride keeps me from apologizing because it's going to open the door to those bad feelings. And everything becomes heightened and shame becomes more of an issue. And because we in a sense, lord it over our kids with these moralistic demands that really come, I think, more from our own psychological needs and our own inability to tolerate aggression, inability to tolerate, you know, what the other parent is thinking about our kid, all kinds of stuff like that.
Robert Caron is a clinical psychologist and the author of The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection.
Please forgive me if I act a little strange, for I know not what I do. Feels like lightning running through my veins every time I look at you. Every time I look at you.
And now for something completely different. Apologies from Monty Python's Flying Circus. It all starts with a dirty fork in a fancy restaurant.
If I may suggest, sir, the pheasant à la reine. The sauce is one of the chef's most famous creations.
Mm, that sounds good. Oh, by the way, I've got a bit of a dirty fork. Could you get me another one?
A bigger bottle?
Well, nothing. I've got a fork, a little bit dirty. Could you get me another one? Thank you.
Oh, sir, I do apologize.
Oh, no need to apologize. Doesn't worry me.
Oh, no. I do apologize. I will fetch the head waiter immediately.
Oh, there's no need to do that.
Oh, no. I'm sure the head waiter, he will want to apologize to you himself. Oh. I will fetch him at once. Oh.
Well, you certainly get good service.
They really look
you?
After you, yes.
Excuse me, sir, madam.
Gaston! Tell the manager what has happened immediately!
No. Please, I don't want to cause any fuss.
Please, it's no fuss. We simply wish to ensure that nothing interferes with your complete enjoyment of the meal.
I'm sure it won't. It was only a dirty fork.
I know. And I'm sorry. Bitterly sorry. But I know that no apologies I can make can alter the fact that in our restaurant, you have been given a dirty, filthy, smelly piece of cutlery.
Was it smelly?
It was smelly and obscene and disgusting. I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. Nasty, grubby, dirty, mangy, scrubby little book.
Good evening, sir. Good evening, madam. I'm the manager. I've only just heard. I want to apologize humbly, deeply, and sincerely about the fork.
Oh, no, please. I was only a tiny bit dirty. I just couldn't see it.
Oh, you're good, kind, fine people for saying that. But I can see it. To me, it's like a mountain, a vast bowl of pus.
Oh,
it gets me here.
I can't give you any excuses for it. There are no excuses. I've been meaning to spend more time in the restaurant recently, but I haven't been too well, and things aren't going very well back there. The poor cook's son has been put away again, and poor old Mrs. Dalrymple, who does the washing up, can hardly move her poor fingers. And then there's Gilberto's war wound. But they're good people. And they're kind people. Together, we were beginning to get over this dark patch. There was light at the end of the tunnel. When this happened!
Could I get you some water?
It's the end of the road!
That is Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There's a tear in my beer, 'cause I'm crying for you, dear. You are on my lonely mind. Into these last 9 beers, I have shed a million tears. You are on my lonely mind.
Humans have developed a unique ability in the animal world. We cry emotional tears. We weep over love lost. We cry from grief. We bawl during sad movies. We even laugh so hard we cry. And a good cry makes us feel better. When neuroscientist Dr. William Fry started to look into the whole business of crying, the ducts and glands that produce tears, he found, to his surprise, that very little was known about this utterly human response.
All of us can tolerate small changes in emotional stress without crying, but when the intensity of the emotion crosses a certain threshold, it triggers this crying response. Receiving bad news, like perhaps news of the death of a friend or relative, for example, triggers changes in the areas of the brain that are involved in emotion in the limbic system. And the brain then sends signals to various other organs, including the pituitary gland, where hormones are released in response to stress, and to the lacrimal glands, or tear glands, where tears are released in response to stress, and you get emotional crying.
So you're saying that we cry essentially when our body is overloaded, when there's too much stress going on. And I guess it raises the question, what happens if we are feeling that intense stress, but we don't cry?
Well, unalleviated emotional stress over a long period of time is very bad because the hormones that are released during stress from the pituitary gland and the adrenal glands in response to that can actually reduce the ability of the brain to use blood sugar or get energy, and that can result in death of nerve cells in the hippocampus of the brain, an area involved in memory and in regulating emotional response.
So you're saying part of the reason why we cry is it's simply a physical purging. The body is getting rid of certain chemicals.
Yes. I have suggested that perhaps the reason people feel better after crying is that they may be removing in their tears chemicals that build up during stress. And so crying is an excretory process. We see that these tears are coming out of the body when people have emotional crying. And we know that people do feel better after crying. 85% of women and 73% of men who we've studied report they do feel better after crying. People feel less sad or less angry, and it seems to be associated with a reduction of emotional stress.
What are the chemicals in tears?
The chemistry of emotional tears is complex and not well understood. We have shown in our studies that emotional tears are chemically different from other kinds of tears, like those that you might cry in response to eye irritation by onions, for example. We know that there's a higher protein concentration in emotional tears. We also know that tears do contain certain hormones that are thought to be associated with stress. However, we really know very little about the chemistry of tears, and especially emotional tears, because it's difficult to collect them and study them.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you actually study this? Does someone hold a little cup under the eye and you somehow induce extreme emotion to see what happens?
That's correct. That's exactly how we do it. We get volunteers. We show them sad movies that we are pretty sure are going to get them to cry. And then we have them hold a little test tube in their hand and collect the tears as they drop out of their eyes into the test tubes. We can then compare those tears with tears that we can get the same individuals on another occasion to cry in response to just exposure to onion vapors from onions that we'll throw into a blender and, you know, open up the top and give them a little whiff of that.
But this is fascinating. You're saying that there actually is a different chemical makeup depending on what kind of tears they are. I mean, there's one kind of tear that comes from sniffing and being exposed to an onion. There's a different kind of tear if we watch a very sad movie. And I suppose there would be another kind of tear if we suddenly bang ourselves and the pain is so extreme that we're crying there. Those are all chemically different kinds of tears.
Well, certainly the emotional tears are chemically different from those that we cry just in response to irritation by onions or other things. Whether there are chemical differences between different types of emotional tears, no one has really determined yet.
Do women and men cry in different ways, or is there something biologically going on that separates the two sexes?
Well, men and women cry quite differently, but this doesn't really show up until after the age of about 12. So if you look at boys and girls that are under the age of 12, the data in the literature suggests that they cry really about the same amount. However, between 12 and 18, we see a very significant difference developing between males and females. And we find that as adults, women are crying on the average about 5.3 times a month. Men are crying on the average about 1.4 times a month.
It's amazing how people can actually study this.
Yeah. Well, we've had people keep detailed records of their crying episodes. And the differences in crying are probably related to the fact that, first, the tear glands in men and women are anatomically different. If you look under the microscope at the tear glands of either adult men or women, or of even rabbits or rats, you find that the male and female tear glands are anatomically different. And the reason they are different is probably related to the fact that hormones, particularly the female hormone prolactin and the male hormone testosterone, are different between the sexes. And these hormones are involved in regulating the development of the lacrimal gland.
What do you make of that admonition that many of us have heard, especially boys and men, they're there, don't cry? What does that tell us about society?
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate thing, and it comes from a basic misunderstanding about the whole crying process. And I think, fortunately, that it's changing somewhat over time. You know, first of all, we never need to tell people they're there, don't cry. When people are crying, they're crying because they're upset. And when they feel better or no longer need to cry, they're going to stop. No one's going to just keep crying on and on forever. One of the unfortunate things that happens is that if young boys or even girls are told that they shouldn't be crying, they find out that it's very difficult to get really upset and not cry. But it's much easier if you don't want to cry, it's easier not to allow yourself to get upset in the first place. This means that they have to cut off the emotional process. They have to somehow distance themselves from their feelings. And that is really an unfortunate thing that can cause problems for them later in life.
So how do you think our culture would be different if we felt freer to cry?
Well, I think our culture would be better, and I think it's moving in that direction. I think that it'll be better because, first, people will be able to use this uniquely human process. When you think about it, there aren't any other physiological secretions that humans have that other animals don't, other than emotional tears. There's a reason why this developed in the human being, and we should be taking advantage of that. And so I think it will be better for our health. Secondly, I think that it will be better for interpersonal relations, because when we cry, it's a mechanism of communicating to other people that something that has happened, perhaps even something that they've said to us, is upsetting to us. And also, it's a form of self-disclosure. It's important because it lets us know ourselves that we are upset. Sometimes people don't realize that they're very upset about something until all of a sudden they feel the tears running down their cheeks. And it tells them, gee, that's really sad to me. I remember one time when I was sitting alone, and my children were quite young at the time, and my grandparents were quite old, and I began to think about how sad it was that my children would never get to really know my grandparents the way that I knew them, and that, you know, by the time my children were old enough to really get to know them and remember them, my grandparents would have died. And I all of a sudden felt, you know, these tears running down my cheeks and realized, you know, from that crying process, how upsetting this whole thing was to me. Not just the loss of my grandparents, but also the failure of my, you know, of the circumstances that were going to prevent my children from really getting to know and care about them the way I did. So I think that crying is something that's very important in terms of self-disclosure.
Dr. William Fry. He's director of the Alzheimer's Research Center at Regents Hospital in Minnesota and the author of Crying, A Mystery of Tears. He talked with Steve Paulson. Just ahead, where abortion, Buddhism, and saying I'm sorry come together in the Far East.
The mizuko rituals in Japan are a very special kind of public apology to a departed fetus, wherever the life of that fetus may now be.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. No issue is more loaded in the United States than abortion. Whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, you run the gauntlet of ideology, and even morality. But the choice to have an abortion is emotionally charged for any woman, and it can generate a lot of long-lasting baggage. William Lafleur has studied how the Japanese respond to abortion. He says they have moved beyond abortion as a moral issue and deal with it only in a spiritual sense. Lafleur told Anne Strangechamps about the mizuko kuyo, the Buddhist ritual of apology to the aborted fetus.
The term mizuko is interesting because the ko part at the end of the word literally means child, and mizu means water. So in a sense, it's a phrase made up of two parts, water and child. In a sense, it's a child that has still been in the waters of the womb, but has also now been released into the universe. Depending on people's beliefs about such things, perhaps now awaiting rebirth to a family that really wants it. I think most Japanese are reluctant to refer to a fetus in strictly mechanical or neutral terms. They prefer not to refer to it merely as an unwanted pregnancy or as some part of flesh that needs to be removed, but they would prefer, I guess, to stretch it a bit and think of it as, at least in some sense, a child on the way. There's enough of the ancient Buddhist thinking about such things in Japan for people, at least in these cases, to be able to think, well, maybe this child will have another chance, and if it's chance to come into the life of a couple that really wants it, rather than the present woman, it will be better off.
It's so interesting, and there's so much to ask, partly because it represents such a completely different way of thinking about and approaching abortion than we have in the States, where we tend to keep it extremely private, and there's still a lot of shame about it. This sounds as though there's perhaps less shame.
There is less shame. In fact, some of the temples will allow people to place a little message in that location, stating in literally written out words an apology to the fetus or the memory of the fetus.
What do they write? What do they say?
They write that they have felt badly about this. Some of them express this in rather graphic terms. They've felt a sense of discomfort ever since they've had an abortion. Women recount having had various kinds of bad dreams and nightmares about the child. And that once they have, in a sense, in our term, fessed up and admitted that they've done something they would rather not have done, not to have had done, they have had some relief in their sensibility and their conscience.
But do they feel that they did something wrong?
That they harmed that child? Oh, sure. I think that seems to be part of why there's an apology being made. They have clearly interrupted the progress of pregnancy and birth on the part of this being. And for that reason, there's been, you know, even physical violence done to this life form. And that's why there is a sense that you can't do that with impunity. You should feel some regret and remorse over that. If you feel that, the best way to handle it is to express it and to go to one of these locations and make an apology.
How long do people observe Mizuko rituals? I mean, is it a thing you do just once or once a year on the anniversary?
There will be people who will stop frequently, maybe once a week, at a roadside shrine that is in some sense devoted to this ritual, and just stop very quickly and go on their way again, just bowing and maybe muttering a prayer expression of apology. Others will make a special effort, maybe once a year or so, out to some more distant site where they feel it is especially appropriate, and there are a kind of collection of sites devoted to this. One of the things I have noticed in recent years is that, although I started first observing this in the 1970s, when it was almost exclusively women who would be found at these sites, now it's not impossible to find a young couple, particularly the male, going along with his wife or perhaps his girlfriend to observe this ritual.
The other thing that was startling to me is to read that Japanese often take siblings with them to the Mizuko
mm-hmm.
ritual.
That's and right.
Siblings take
That's
part.
Right.
Why is
That's
that?
Right. The emphasis is upon trying to indicate to the departed fetus that out of sight does not mean entirely out of mind, that it still is remembered as, in some sense, a member of this family, even though it's a departed member. It's important to see this in the context of a more general Japanese pattern, maybe a more general East Asian pattern, of thinking of deceased ancestors also as gone but not forgotten. The larger family is, in some sense, invisibly present. So, too, this child would be invisibly present. Therefore, to indicate to living siblings, odd word to use in this case, but it is regarded as a sibling, that there is another child or maybe even children who have already departed this world is not considered a bad thing. I think that's the sense. I mean, I've seen lots of women at these sites bringing their children along with them, you know, in a sense, introducing them to this fact about the family's life.
How do the siblings respond, do you think?
I
mean,
is this horrifying
to them, frightening? Is it just a fact of life?
I think it's probably, I mean, I doubt that anybody goes, for a young child, goes into the details of what is involved in the physical side of an abortion. But I imagine, well, I know, in fact, that the language used with respect to a living sibling concerning the aborted fetus is that of a deceased sibling. In other words, it's probably at that level no more disturbing or horrifying to the child than to become aware that there was another child in the family who predeceased it.
I guess what I'm wondering is if they think of the Mizuko as a child, they're simply saying, it's not a good time for you to come into life now. But if they believe that the Mizuko is going to go on and perhaps be born to other parents.
Right, right.
Well, it relieves a lot of guilt. Does it make abortion more common, easier to have?
It is more common in Japan. The statistics are higher. But I think in a sense, what I'm talking about here is namely the way in which the fetus is conceived of or thought of in religious terms and philosophical terms does make it ethically easier to carry out an abortion, especially if you are expressing then afterward your sense that this is not something you really like doing or really want to be doing. I think there's a lot of interesting good study coming out now showing that apologies are not just to repair the fabric of human relationships, but also are a way in which the person making an apology says to himself or herself, you know, I'm not really the kind of person that likes to do the thing I have done.
A form of self-correction in a way.
Right. It's a way of saying that, you know, I'm not this person who's done this. I mean, obviously I've done it. But the real person, in this case, the person, let's say, who's had an abortion, or the husband who's convinced his wife she ought to have an abortion, we've done this because of a variety of circumstances, foolishness on our part, lack of protection, lack of contraception, whatever may be the reason. But it's not at this time a good time for us to have a child. Maybe we're unmarried. Maybe we already have more children than we can handle well. So we're going to have this abortion. And the apology is saying, in a sense, we are not people who like to engage in acts like this.
William Lafleur is the author of Liquid Life, Abortion and Buddhism in Japan. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for I'm Sorry, program number 127A. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or email us through our website at www.wpr.org/book. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Americans are from Mars, and Europeans are from Venus. It's the view of foreign policy analyst Robert Kagan. He says Europeans no longer believe in military power, quite unlike America's leaders. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the growing split between Europe and America, and the peace treaty that carved up Iraq some 80 years ago. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.